welcome to the very first episode of The Smallest Thing. I'm Lisa Manterfield. Every week I'll be sharing a new chapter of my second novel, The Smallest Thing. The book came out originally in 2017 and was produced as an audiobook in 2019. But the story's suddenly become very timely as we're all affected by the coronavirus outbreak. As of a week ago, my county issued a shelter-in-place order. And like many of you, I'm now staying home for the foreseeable future. So, I decided it was time to stop thinking about this project and just do it. I'll be sharing this book in its entirety for free as a weekly podcast. I'll be talking about what's going on in the world, share with you some background about the story. I'll interview some people I think you might find interesting and try to answer your questions. Mostly, I'm hoping to provide a little relief from what we're all going through right now. I'll be here all the way to the end of the book, so be sure to subscribe and come back next week. Now, if you can't wait to get to the next episode, which I hope you won't, the book is available in paperback, ebook, and audiobook formats at online retailers. You can also support your local independent bookstore by asking your friendly bookseller to order a copy. You can also find information about me, The Smallest Thing, and my other books at lisamanterfield.com. Now, fair warning, this is a book about a young woman trapped in quarantine. But it's not a horror story. It's a story about human connection and community and above all hope, which I think are things we're all thinking about right now. This might feel like a funny time to listen to this book, but I believe that stories have the power to transport us and make us feel like we're not alone in this crazy world. So today I'm going to take you to the historic village of Eme, where you'll meet 17-year-old Emmett Siddall. Em is a girl stuck in the very last place on earth she wants to be. She has big dreams to get out of her dull English village, and she's also a girl with a plan to do it. But something strange is going on in the village, and Em's plans are about to be derailed. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Join me after, and I'll tell you more about the real-life village of Eme and its tragic history that inspired this book. For now, pull up a chair, grab your beverage of choice, and enjoy episode 1 of The Smallest Thing. Welcome to the serialized audiobook, The Smallest Thing, written by Lisa Manterfield, read for you by Charlie Sanderson.
This book is dedicated to the humanitarian aid workers who risk their lives in service to others. Chapter 1. Sunday, July the 17th. It's close to midnight before the house falls silent, and I'm sure Dad is asleep. I roll out of bed and dig out the clothes I've stashed under my keep calm and carry on pillow. Sleeping out of my pyjamas, I feel the sting of the cool night air against my skin. I pull on jeans and a cami, then cover up with a baggy sweatshirt, knowing I won't be wearing it for long. Holding my breath, I ease up the handle of my window and feel the locks slide from their slots. With a sharp press against the wooden frame, the seals break like the pop of a champagne cork muffled inside a tea towel. I freeze, listening for any sign of disturbance from down the hall. Mum and my little sister Alice are the light sleepers, but I doubt they'd hear me tonight from 300 miles away. Dad sleeps like the dead. I push open the window and peer at the garden below. In the long violet midsummer half-light, Dad's potting bench is just visible. It looks a long way down. I know that climbing out of the window is a childish thing to do. I'm almost 18, for pity's sake, close to official adulthood. I should be able to leave by the front door like a normal person. But if Dad had any inkling of where I was going, or why, or, most especially, with whom, he'd nail the front door shut. If he insists on treating me like a child, then a child he gets. Out the window I go. I dangle a foot over the ledge until it meets the roof of the sunroom. Swinging myself over the edge, I drop soundlessly onto the potting bench, feeling the weathered timber lurch beneath me. I do a quick check that the coast is clear and scurry across the garden, over the low back wall, and out into the village. My heart thuds in my throat, pumping euphoria through my veins. I am free. Flashing across the open village green, I duck into the shadow of the war memorial and check for gimlet-eyed neighbours. An upstairs light is on in Dr. Spencer's cottage. If he's about to leave for a house call, he's bound to spot me. News travels faster than the plague around here, and if I'm seen, my dad will know about it in 10 seconds flat. But I have to risk it. I have to see Ro. I sprint for the edge of the churchyard and hunker down below the wall, out of sight, trying to catch my breath. The air is warm tonight, and the breeze picks up the scent of freshly turned earth from the other side of the mossy limestone wall. I've had to borrow one of Mum's black dresses twice this week to attend the funerals of elderly neighbours, a rare occurrence even in a village with as many oldies as ours. At both services, everyone talked about good people, solid members of the community, their quiet lives well lived. In other words, two perfectly good lives wasted away in the dullest corner of the British Isles. Alongside the churchyard's newest residents are the sunken graves of 10 traceable generations of my ancestors. The dead siddles, as I call them. Person after person who never had the guts or the wherewithal to leave the village of Eam. It boggles my mind to think that most of them never even saw London, never had the urge to uproot and try a different life. When I think of all the invaders who travelled from far-off lands to conquer our little island, the Vikings, the Romans, the Normans, and all the adventurers who sailed the uncharted seas in search of new worlds, I can't believe I ended up descended from people who never aspired to anything more than the simple country life. Well, that family tradition ends with me. I'm moving to our capital, no matter who tries to stop me, and I swear I am never coming back. At the crest of the hill, I clamber through a rocky entrance, shining the light from my phone onto the damp rock walls around me. A few uneven steps, and I burst out into Cooklet Delf, an open grassy bowl rimmed with trees. At the bottom, a narrow path crosses the stream that marks the Eam village boundary and meets a rough track coming from Rose Farm on the hillside opposite. The tingle of adventure prickles my skin and my breath becomes shallow with anticipation. Only now that I am no longer in danger of being caught am I suddenly afraid. Ro and I have talked and dreamed about this possibility for months, since the first night we met. But now I've made it real, and my doubts about his resolve come creeping in. From the darkness, the sound of boots crunching against the stony path moves my way. I tuck my hair behind one ear and lean against the rock beside me, trying to look casual, willing my heart to be quiet. I feel Ro's presence coming closer and closer, until I can hear his breath and see his dark, rangy silhouette. His arms wrap around my waist and pull me towards him. When his lips slip against mine, I finally relax.
"Well, this is an unexpected treat,"
he mumbles at last, his mouth brushing against the top of my head, softening his voice. "I needed to see you." His fingers touch the purple streak in my pale hair.
"Sneaking out at night? You're turning into a right rebel, aren't you?"
I don't answer at first. I'm not a rebel, not really. I'm just a girl who's ready to start her real life. But if I want to be the person I know I am, and less like the girl my parents think I should be, I'm going to have to make some waves. "I got the job," I blurt, getting straight to the point.
"Really?"
he asks, and I'm not sure if his tone is excitement or shock. "She rang me today. It's only 3 nights a week to start, but she says the tips are good and I can probably pick up extra shifts. Plus, that will leave my days free to work on my mosaics and take them around the markets. And you're not going to believe this. She said she'd listen to your demo and think about bringing you in."
"You're kidding,"
he says. This time, he's definitely excited.
"Yep, and look at this."
I pull out my phone and show Ro the room I found for rent. I pause on the picture that shows the window facing a tiny courtyard and not the one facing a faded brick wall. I definitely don't show him the kitchen the size of a shoebox or the avocado-coloured bathroom with a wall decoration that looks alarmingly like toxic mould. I've got enough saved for the deposit and 2 months' rent, plus whatever you have. I think we can do it. We can finally get out of here. I can barely contain my excitement, but I sense Rose's hesitance through the darkness. When do you start? He asks. She wants me August 1st. It's all happened so fast, much faster than I'd imagined, and I'm scrambling to put the pieces of my plan together. It will be a lot easier if Ro doesn't put up a fight. He pulls back and peers at me in the dim light. That's only 2 weeks away. What do you folks think? I let out a long sigh that feels like it's been trapped inside my whole life. It's all Ro needs to understand that my rebel streak has yet to extend to telling my dad any of this. This is stupid, Em, all this sneaking around. I should be able to pick up my girlfriend at a front door and take her out, not always have to meet her where we won't be seen. And now you're escaping through the window like bloody Rapunzel. Technically, the prince snuck in to see Rapunzel, but now's not the time to quibble over details. I'm not the greatest fan of risking my life either, but you know what my dad's like. And you think he's going to let you go to London? Why do you even need his approval? Until I turn 18, there's a long list of things I can't do without an adult to vouch for me, including renting a mould-infested room in a flat with 3 strangers and a boyfriend voted least likely for parental approval. And, technically, I can only work as a barback until I'm legal to serve drinks. But I won't bore Ro with that hitch just yet, either. If the job offer had come a month later, I wouldn't be in this pickle. But it didn't, and so I am. Then let's just go, I tell him. We can put the flat in your name and my parents can approve or not. Who cares? We might not get another chance like this, and as long as we have each other, we can work out the rest when we get there. Ro's gaze roams across my face, and for the smallest of moments, I think he's going to say no. And then he throws back his head, his long dark hair flying around his face, and howls like a wolf on the prowl. Emmett Siddall, you've got balls, he yelps. Oh no, I don't, I say. I'll prove it. I grab his hand, pulling him off the path and into the soft grass, peeling off my sweatshirt as I go. Ro shucks his jacket and fumbles with the button on my jeans, sending up the scent of coconut from his hair and a whiff of rugged leather. As he kisses me down into the grass, I'm enveloped in the primal scent of moist earth and fresh bracken, its spores warmed by the summer sun and primed for release. With the babble of the stream for background music, I fantasise about a lumpy bed in a damp room with a window that faces a wall, and, finally, I feel alive. Ro slings his arm around my shoulder as he walks me back to the village. We press together down the narrow path, so close we look like a 3-legged monster. But neither of us speaks. As a bank of clouds rolls across the moor, blotting out the last of the moonlight, the temperature drops and he pulls away from me. You know I love you, don't you? He says. Of course, I say back. But something prickles just underneath my skin, a sense that he wants to say more, that there's a but to this declaration. I don't press him because I don't want to hear it, and he doesn't continue. So we walk in a silence that I fill with plans. How are you going to get back in the house? He asks as we reach the edge of the churchyard. My London daydreams lurch to a halt. Oh, bugger, I haven't thought about that. My plan to get out was flawless. My plan to get back in is non-existent. There's no way I can climb back up to the window. I have seriously cocked up, and when my dad finds out, the days I'm counting down until I move out will feel more like a lifetime. As we round the corner, a trio of bright blue flashing lights illuminates the village green.
Oh, bugger me!
I hiss, pulling away from Ro. If my empty room has been discovered and my dad has wigged out and called the police, I'm a dead woman. If he catches me with Ro, I'm buried as well. If Dad ever actually met Ro in person and gave him even a sliver of a chance, he'd see he wasn't so bad. But Ro's dad's farm once belonged to a Siddle, and although the feud was buried over a century ago, the Tory name will forever be synonymous with land thieves and charlatans. And people wonder why I want to leave. Ro takes a step backward, no doubt having similar thoughts. But as we skim the churchyard wall, I can see that the lights come not from a police car, but an ambulance. Several villagers have gathered around, and there's no way I could get by without being seen. Something bad's happened, I say. You should go. He pulls me into the churchyard's lich gate and gives me a long, hard kiss. Don't get caught, he whispers, then scoots off into the darkness. Slipping around the edge of the village green, I pat down my swollen lips and flushed face, trying to look as if I've just stepped outside to see what's going on. I glance back at Ro for a last snatch of moral support, but he's long gone. I have no option now but to get out of this mess alone. A small group, fleece jackets and fluffy dressing gowns wrapped hurriedly over their nightwear, has gathered near the gate of Dr. Spencer's cottage. At the centre, our neighbour, Mrs. Glover, holds court, her hands waving excitedly. An ambulance in the village could be the highlight of her year, a guaranteed source of gossip for the nosy old bats. I inch into the periphery of the cluster, but before I can glean what's going on, the front door of Dr. Spencer's cottage opens and a paramedic backs out, jockeying one end of a stretcher. A second paramedic has the other end, and between them, under a white blanket, lies the stocky form of the young doctor who confirmed I was healthy as a horse at my checkup just last week. He had seemed completely fine. Even through the semi-darkness and flash of blue lights, I can see his handsome face is pale and glossy, as if this is a wax version of the compassionate man who always warms his stethoscope. An oxygen mask is secured across his face and his eyes are glazed. Down one side of his cheek is a dark rivulet that appears to have come from his nose. My mouth goes dry. I am fairly certain the rivulet is blood. The chatter among the group stills as Dr. Spencer is carried by. Each of us shrinks back, as if hounded by a fog-like sense of doom. Whatever has happened to Dr. Spencer is serious. I pull away, leaning out of the fog's reach. As the solemn procession moves past, Dr. Spencer's unfocused eyes suddenly seem to clarify, his stare connecting with mine. In that wild-eyed glance, I see fear. I hold his gaze, the blood chilling in my veins, finding myself in the disconcerting position of offering our family doctor my silent reassurance that he will be okay. And then the paramedics load him into the ambulance and pull away.
What's going on?
An all too familiar voice says behind me. I keep my eyes forward, praying my dad won't recognise me, won't sense the presence of his own flesh and blood.
Emmett,
he says. Truly, I have no luck. I'm ready with a lie about being woken by the commotion, but Mrs. Glover, God love her, saves me by pouncing on the opportunity to share valuable information with my dad. It was just the flu is all, she gushes. But it took a terrible turn. I heard the fuss next door and then the ambulance arrived. Poor lad looks awful. My dad nods gravely.
Where's Louise?
He asks. His question is answered when Dr. Spencer's wife steps out of the house, closing the door behind her. In her loose sweatshirt pulled over pink polka dot pyjamas, Louise looks like a little girl who's woken up from a bad dream. Pale, disoriented, and frightened. She's a barely recognisable remnant of the energetic leader of our village conservation group. It's the change in Louise that shocks me into realising how serious the situation is. For a second, Dad looks torn between the panicked old lady and the vulnerable young woman, his wayward daughter temporarily forgotten.
"I'll drive you to the hospital," he tells Louise,
taking her by the elbow and guiding her to his car. He's only gone a few steps before he turns to me and narrows his eyes. I think for certain he's going to come down on me like a ton of bricks. I prepare for a public humiliation of epic proportions. But instead, he says,
"Make yourself useful and make Mrs. Glover a cup of tea, and then get yourself home."
As I watch his receding back, a flicker of anger flares inside me. Is my father really so consumed with the welfare of our neighbours that he's oblivious to his daughter's covert activities? Or does he simply not care? As his car pulls away and my neighbours disperse back to their beds, I wonder if I've just been handed the freedom I've been fighting so hard to win. If Dad has given up trying to control me, my victory feels far less sweet than I'd expected.
"I don't know what we'd do around here without your dad," Mrs. Glover says,
shuffling her slippered feet back toward her house. It's meant as a compliment, but beneath her words, I hear the sting of comparison, the suggestion that she finds me lacking. A knot of fury unravels inside me, and I'm reminded of why I hate it here. No matter what I do, no matter where I go, no matter what I accomplish in my life, I will always be measured against the standard of my dad, a man who never left the village he was born in, who is proud to descend from similarly unambitious blood. She's right that I am nothing like him, but I will always be judged as something less. I step toward the old woman, determined to set her straight, but then I remember, I'm leaving. I don't have to be nice, and I don't have to live up to my dad's standards anymore. "Make your own cup of tea," I say. And with that, I march home to bed. I don't go back to sleep, though. I toss and turn for hours, planning my escape to London one minute and feeling bad for telling off Mrs. Glover the next. I barely feel I've slept when, sometime around dawn, I get a text from Dad. Dr. Spencer is dead.
Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that chapter. Em's village of Eme is a real village in northern England. It's not too far from where I grew up, in Sheffield. And the book that I wrote, The Smallest Thing, is inspired by real events that happened in Eme in 1665. So when the Great Plague was raging through London, about 150 miles away from Eme, a tailor brought a bolt of cloth to the village. The cloth got wet and he put it by the fire to warm up. And the fleas that were in that cloth in 1665 was not uncommon, became active and brought with them the plague. The plague soon started spreading through the village, house by house, cottage by cottage. And eventually the people of the village decided that the right thing to do would be to self-quarantine, which probably wasn't an expression in those days. The village is probably about a half an hour now from what was then a big market town of Sheffield, which is where I'm from. And the people knew that if the plague made it to Sheffield, that there could be untold thousands of people who would contract it and die. There's no medicines, no vaccines, nothing like that in those days. And so they made this really, really courageous decision to quarantine themselves. As a child, I was just fascinated by this story. I remember going to visit Eme and seeing the cottages that the people had lived in 350 years ago. Going into the church and seeing the stained glass window where the story was depicted. And listening to the stories of characters like Emmett Siddall, who was a young girl who lived in the village, but her fiancé lived outside the village. And so they were cut off from one another by this quarantine. And I just remember thinking what a romantic story that was, and how they would visit one another across the quarantine boundary. And I wanted to find a way to retell that story in a way that was relevant today. And I didn't want to write it as historical fiction. That has been done very, very well by Geraldine Brooks in her fantastic novel, Year of Wonders. Check that out if you haven't already. But I wanted to write a contemporary version. And I started thinking about what would happen if that story happened today. Now, keep in mind, this was around 2014 that I started rewriting that book, and had no idea that we would soon find out for ourselves what would happen. But that question is when I spoke to the curator of the museum there in Eam, which is a fabulous museum. She said that's the question that people ask most often. What would happen today if a small village had some kind of deadly virus? Would they choose to quarantine? What would it be like? And so that was the inspiration for the book, The Smallest Thing. I took Emmett Siddall, the real character from that story, and made her a modern-day teen. I made her a little bit of a rebel and put her in this quite dull English village for a teenager in the middle of nowhere, and threw this epidemic at her. And this is the story that unfolds. So I'll tell you in future episodes a little bit more about how this premise sort of unfolded into the story that you will be listening to here on this podcast. And I'm also going to tell you more about the village, which is still a very active village today. That'll come up in future episodes as well. But in the meantime, if you have questions you'd like answered, or if you have topics that you would like me to discuss here, please contact me through my website. It's lisa@lisamantifield.com. And next week, come back, find out what happens to Dr. Spencer, and I'll take you on a virtual tour of the present-day village of Eam, tell you a little bit more about what's going on there today. So until next week, stay safe, stay healthy, and don't forget to wash your hands. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Smallest Thing. To make sure you don't miss next week's episode, you can subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and more. If you'd like to support the show, please leave a review and share this series with others you think might enjoy it. If you're on Instagram, tag me there at @LisaMantifield_. Or follow me on Facebook at @AuthorLisaMantifield and Twitter @@LisaMantifield. My newsletter subscribers are always the first to know about my news, events, upcoming releases, giveaways, and more. Sign up for monthly delivery at lisamantifield.com/subscribe and get your complimentary copy of Love, Loss, and Letting Go, 3 of my short stories. Thanks to Justin Joseph for producing and editing this show, and to Ketsa.uk for the music. That's all for this episode. Thanks for listening.